Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome back my guest co-host today, Dr. Jessica Hart from UNC Family Medicine. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi. Thanks, Adam.
It's great to have you back again today. And on our show, we're going to be talking with Dr. Eric Paraxlis, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, as well as Chief Information Officer and Chief Scientist of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, about cybersecurity and healthcare, what we should know. I'm very excited. Nervous, but looking forward to the conversation.
I am too. It's not in our typical curriculum in residency yet.
But you know what? We hear it and see it all the day, these phishing scams that come to us wanting to get information about patients and just things that we need to know to protect security of patients, protect our own security. Looking forward to this. But first, we've got some interesting research that matters. We're going to be talking about sleep and sick days.
Next, we're going to be talking about men and domestic violence.
About the nursing home care, and does it matter the type of work environment of the nurses?
And finally, teen drug use.
And we're hopefully going to have some good news. So first, about this sleeping and sick days. And if you sleep 7 to 8 hours a night, you have fewer sick days. How much sleep do you get, Jessica?
I know
you're a resident, so you know, with this.
I try for seven. I typically get around that, but we'll see when I start in the hospital.
Well, and I know that if I get less than six or less, I really am kind of tired and don't feel so good that next day. So this study, this research was of Finnish workers, and they looked at almost 2,000 women and almost 2,000 men over the age of 30.
And it was interesting. They found, taking age into account, that men who had frequent insomnia symptoms had more than 10 sick days per year, compared to only 5 absences for men who never had symptoms.
Yeah. And those who had the 7 to 8 hours, who had the fewest sick days a year. This was kind of the optimal sleep duration was 7 hours and 46 minutes. You have to get one of those apps that can help you figure that out. And this was published in the journal Sleep. That's the right, seems like the right journal for that. And I guess I really like the way they framed this, that sleeping could be associated with regular sleep with better, not just sleeping, but eating, exercising, general well-being, coping with stress, all the things that go along with good sleep patterns.
Exactly. And more importantly, helping with maintaining peak cognitive performance throughout the day, is even if people are making it to work, wanting to make sure that they're performing as they should with maximum amount of sleep.
Well, this next research that matters is about a topic that's been all over the news, and it's about domestic violence, where men are hurting their spouses. And I think this is a new research that doesn't just look at it from like the end result of once this happened, but begins to ask us, could we perhaps identify it earlier? What's this research about, Jessica?
So this was a study that was published in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine, and it showed that 1 of 5 men surveyed reported using violence towards their spouse or significant other.
And this was actually, I found just like, whoa, you know, because this would say, you know, this is people that we probably know in our environments, because it wasn't just like rare. And that half of these men who had some sort of violent act towards their spouse had actually been in to see the doctor in the year before this occurred, indicating that physicians have a lot of interactions with these people before these events occur.
That's right. And most of our efforts have been focusing on preventing intimate partner violence when speaking with women who are the victims. But it looks like there should be a shift as well to identify aggressive behavior and potentially intervene in men that we are concerned could be participating in domestic violence.
And what they defined as domestic partner violence was pushing, grabbing, shoving, throwing something, slapping, hitting, kicking, biting, beating up, choking, burning, scalding, threatening with a knife or gun. I think, we need to stop this. Hopefully some of the attention that's come about in the media has been for good. I'm hopeful, at least.
Absolutely.
Our next research that matters is a little bit of a hopeful story here, but it is this question about if you're the nurses who provide home care, if they have good work environments, are there better outcomes for you as a patient? Not a question I would have necessarily thought of, but I think it's an important question.
I agree. This study was published in Medical Care, the October issue of Medical Care. And we know home health is one of the fastest growing healthcare sectors and serve actually 4.5 million patients annually. And unfortunately, they're going to be suffering about 14% cut in Medicare payments between 2014 to 2017. So there's concern that the budget shortage will affect the quality of care that they're able to provide.
Yeah, and the way home health agencies might reduce costs by increasing the workloads on the nurses, and this would suggest it could reduce quality of care because there are reduced readmissions in the 118 medical certified home health agencies in the three states they looked at, and keeping patients healthy and engaged. I think this suggests that we got a long way to go here, but we can't, you know, cut on the one end and expect there's not going to have something bad that's going to happen on the other here. The health environment of the people who provide care is really important.
Absolutely.
Our last research that matters, Jessica, is about drug use in teens. And we had some of the leading North Carolina staff that were doing research on the YRBS, Uterus Behavioral Survey, in North Carolina. And this is actually some national data that was released about drug use nationally.
And there's actually some good news. Teen drug use is down from 13% to 8.8%.
Yeah, and fewer teens were reporting alcohol use. Fewer teens were reporting perhaps opioid abuse. Fewer teens are reporting multiple forms of drug use. There was some research that just came out from the North Carolina Youth Tobacco Survey showing cigarette use was down. However, they're probably not all good news because it's still pretty high, pretty devastating. And certainly there are some still strong concerns about marijuana use among particularly youth, given some of the changes legally and the fact that there were almost 20 million people reporting using marijuana use in their latest survey. And as far as youth goes, this is a little concerning, I think.
It is. It'll be interesting to see if data changes with the new adoption in Colorado and Oregon of legalization of marijuana.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Eric Paroxlis, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, about cybersecurity and healthcare, what we should know. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. Today on Conversations, Jessica, we're talking with Dr. Eric Paroxlis, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, as well as the former Chief Information Officer at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, about cybersecurity in healthcare, what we should know.
Welcome to our program, Dr. Paroxlis, and I wanted to ask how you got interested in your profession, particularly cybersecurity.
Thank you. I'm actually an engineer and scientist by training, and I spent a lot of time in the technology interface with science. And really what I was interested in doing is doing open science and sharing data. And I was raised, I spent a lot of time at Johnson & Johnson, so I view myself as an alumni of there. I was there for 13 years. And they had a strong culture of compliance, and that compliance was a competitive advantage. So the main way I could get to publish and share data and do open science was if I actually mastered the complexities of it. Things like cloud computing required a lot more security, and a lot of the consortia and international deals that we did required a lot of security. And then, of course, at FDA, it became a much larger part of my life when I was CIO there, because it's such a key piece to the IT mission at FDA, all aspects of cyber protection.
Well, help us just dive in there. And in the interest of disclosure, we should say that you just really published an influential perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine, which kind of came to our attention. But when we talk about this cybersecurity in healthcare, why are we talking about it, and how big is the problem?
It's a great question. You know, one thing that you understand being at FDA and being in drug discovery and development is that medicines are often about benefit risk. Well, technology is actually also about benefit versus risk. And I think that when there are new technological advances, people rightfully try to very quickly bring them to promise and bring them to use. A lot of places have implemented a lot of electronic medical record systems. There's new screening systems. There's all types of patient portals and lots of things that people have built to both achieve innovation and efficiency. But like a lot of things, when they're first new, people don't always have the time to think all the way through the downstream consequences of these things. At the same time that health information technology has made these great strides, also what we've seen is just this unfortunate boom industry of cyber theft and other forms of cyber crime. And, you know, we can't get through a day without seeing something large in the paper about it. So I think a lot of times you rush to progress, and that's the right thing to do. But every once in a while, you've got to kind of slow up and say, okay, what are the unintended consequences risk-wise of what's happened here, and how do we catch that aspect up?
So what are the four major areas of cyber theft, cybersecurity, and healthcare? You listed four in your New England Journal of Medicine, and I wonder if you could just kind of review the types of things that are really a problem.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So the different things are, of course, there's reputational type attacks where sometimes people do this for mischief, or hacktivism type attacks, and we've seen incidences of that recently. There's theft, which is often an obvious thing that people do. There's also the aspect where possibly people are trying to change data or manipulate data, mm-hmm. and that's often a type of thing that something does. I'm sorry, that people can do. And there are lots of other, I guess there are really variations on those themes. Intrusion, breaking in, spying, those types of things can also all be done.
All of which are kind of scary.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I really tried not to make the article too scary, and the intention there is that I don't think really scared people always make the best decision. So,
well, our society is very technologically savvy this day and age. So how simple is it to hack into these healthcare systems, knowing that they range from small private clinics all the way up to large university institutions?
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways to look at that. One is you actually don't – a lot of what goes on doesn't happen because somebody hacked in. Data can be released by accident, and you know, about a third of what goes on that you see is actual crime. A lot of times, cyber intrusion or data releases or things like that are unintentional, either by an accident that a person does, a well-meaning person just makes a mistake.
Like what? Can you give us an example of what?
Yeah,
you're
I mean, the type of thing that I have seen before is in the conduct of clinical trials, for an example, a nurse may be trying to send some data or a practitioner or a clerk, and when they go to email, they pull down someone's name and they accidentally send it to their Gmail account instead of their work email account.
Oops.
You know, those types of things. And, you know, the person wasn't doing anything wrong. There's a busy person and made an honest mistake. The other thing that happens is technology mistakes are another third of it. And so this is a case where, for example, a computer programmer is doing some work on a firewall and leaves a door open after they're done, and someone finds that open door. And then about a third of the time, it's actually people trying that are intentionally trying to break in or steal their way on. So I think that's one of the important things about to understand about cybersecurity is a lot of times it's actually not about the technology or kind of trying to build a fortress around your computers to do that. A lot of what could go on is accidental. It's training, it's learning, it's knowledge, it's those types of things.
You know, when we had in the last few weeks to months, we have read about, you know, tens of millions of people in Target or tens of millions in Home Depot, P.F. Chang, these large consumer markets where you see these large numbers of the American public. What are the types of major national concerns in healthcare? Are there ones that would be ones that we should be equally concerned?
Well, I think there are some that could be very concerning. So, for example, we've seen, and there have been some recent articles about hacktivist attacks on hospitals. And we've seen articles situations that I referenced and others about people stealing from hospitals. I think what can be very concerning is the fact that, you know, you've got a vulnerable population in these facilities that are essentially in and amongst an Internet of Things that is not necessarily well controlled. And people talk about stealing data or these types of things that you can do. And, you know, the really scary part of someone actually interfering with a system that's connected to a patient, they don't necessarily have to make the machine do anything. Just changing data could lead to accidents. So, I mean, I think these areas really need to be secured. There needs to be that extra level of thought and management about devices and how medical devices, the protection and resiliency of those devices to being tampered with. And I think that's a really important point, because nobody wants to see anybody get hurt under any circumstance. So first and foremost, you've got to do that. And if, as a healthcare institution, what I've encouraged people to do is think about that on a continuum of risk management. So for example, people understand things, risk management of hospital-borne infections or surgical errors or other things. Well, where should cybersecurity fit on that line? And how should it be resourced, and how should it be fit in? So one of the things I like to talk about is I actually don't think cybersecurity is as much a technology or IT issue as it can be a risk management issue in the continuum of patient protection within a hospital. I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that some of these things teach us is that people are smart, and you don't have to do something. So for example, if you take the Target case, it's pretty well publicized that they didn't have to hack Target. They just had to hack one of Target's providers. So I don't have to get through Target's firewall. I just need to hack one of their contractors and let them carry the intrusion into the big company for me. So that's the other reason I'm not a big fan of large fortress mentality when it comes to these things, because these folks are really smart, and they don't go the hard way. They find the easy way in.
So how would you counsel organizations to beef up their security to prevent these attacks?
I think they have to stratify their risk, like I said, with what are they worried about? You know, what is your risk management policy? What's your disaster plans and things like that? I think you've got to do that. I think cybersecurity is actually an aspect of engineering instead of being something that you hire someone else to do. So you're engineering and working with systems that are easily made secure. I also think that, you know, you should really think about training people on the proper use of devices. And I think training is probably the biggest bang for the buck you can get, making sure people don't share passwords, making sure people don't take their hospital laptop and jump onto the wireless at Starbucks. Where, you know, those types of things actually lead to a lot more types of breaches than, you know, the people actually finding a way through a hospital's firewall.
You know, it's the human and the human engineer equation.
It really is. I think people understand that that's the easy way in.
Yeah, we're going to need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to continue our great conversation with Dr. Eric Parakselix, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, about cybersecurity in healthcare, what we should know. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Parakselix, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, as well as the former Chief Information Officer and Chief Scientific Officer for Informatics at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, about cybersecurity in healthcare, what we should know. And right before we had a break, Dr. Parakselix, you mentioned about this really need to have human thoughts, human training to prevent human mistakes. And I guess one of the things that is implied is that a lot of things really could be prevented. Talk about the theft of laptops, the theft of mobile devices. Do we are we prepared for this? Should we be doing more?
That's a great question. I think that it's I mean, if you look at what has happened so far, it's obviously one of the leading ways that these incidents happen, and it's also one of the leading ways that people end up with HIPAA fines or things like that, is the loss of a laptop. I mean, I've heard of a case where an ultrasound machine was lost, for example, and it had data on it, of course. So the idea of endpoint security, understanding what the devices are that have access to different layers of your network, your patient data, and other data, and how you're actually securing them is quite important. That's you know, my comment about the Internet of Things, which is often used in a very positive way to describe what's going on. But it's also a bit of a Wild West if you walk through a typical hospital lobby and look at the numbers and types of devices that are all jumping on and off networks. It can be quite difficult to know what's going on.
Well, that's a little sobering. And what do we do about as patients? What types of advice do you have? Because I know we'll come back and talk about some of the solutions here. But if you're a patient, are there things that patients should be doing or can advocate for to help improve the safety and cybersecurity of their information?
Yeah, I think that there is a need for people in general, patients, consumers, to educate themselves on what they should and shouldn't be doing with their own information. It's really interesting. You know, if you look at the clinical trials world, at a time when cybersecurity and concerns about personal information theft are going so high, we're also seeing huge emergence in these great things like citizen science, where people are building patient registries on Facebook and putting all types of data out there. It's actually a dichotomy. But I think, you know, one of the things that I tell folks is to if they're going to educate themselves, one bit of advice I try to give people is, you know, one way that the government has been dealing with this at some of the highest levels is, if you assumed you were breached, what would you do? And one way to do that is saying that if I'm assuming that there's spyware on my computer at home, what would I do? Well, what I would do is I would have someone monitor what people were doing with that information. So actually, one of the best things that people can do is either work with one of the credit monitoring services or some of the security monitoring services like LifeLock. Not that I want to advocate for their particular service, but what they actually do is watch to find out when someone is actually trying to do something with your data. Because if you assume your data is actually out, then really what you're going to do is say, well, I need to know if someone's trying to get a credit card in my name, because that could damage my credit, or apply for a mortgage. Interestingly enough, I won't say where it is, but one of my financial, one of the folks that manages my financial stuff jokingly says at this large institution that he actually uses his Social Security number as his password, because he figures it's the most public thing about him, even though everyone tries to hide it. So I think the idea that, you know, monitoring what may actually be going on, this actually goes on in institutions as well. Antivirus protection is 4 to 6% effective. All antivirus software knows is to tell you if it finds something it already knew existed. So what a lot of more advanced things do is if they assume that you might be breached, what they're doing is they're looking for traffic going out that's not authorized. So in some ways, I may not know what's sitting on my servers, but I'm going to monitor who my servers are talking to. And that's a little complex, but that's what some of these credit monitoring and other services do. They look for when someone tries to use your information to do something.
Taking this a little different way, I know Vice President Cheney was concerned when he had a cardiac device implanted that someone would be able to have access to that and cause him harm. Is that a real threat or more of a hypothetical?
Those types of things, I think, are actually real, and I think it's something that people have to think about. Now, there's different aspects to that, because on one hand, you can say that with an electromagnetic pulse, I could disrupt any device, and it's not really a cyber intrusion. It's more of a type of trauma that could go on. But I think the ability to influence medical systems, so for example, if someone has an electronic medical record system, what if I changed everybody's potassium value by one? In that record, what could that possibly do? It could actually probably lead to a lot of mistakes. So the ability of change in data, those things are actually quite real. And that's why I'm saying, I think in healthcare, because of the vulnerable population, because of the types of decisions that go on in the clinic, and because of the fact that some folks are, as you mentioned in your example, possibly even physically connected to these devices, I think it really warrants an extra layer of thought and intention about what we do and how we do it. And I think there's a lot going on right now in the regulatory space where people are trying to grapple with how to handle this.
So you mentioned once in your article that compliance with regulatory frameworks like the HIPAA, or the Healthcare Information Portability Act, that really ensures that we try to not have this be so public in terms of violations, doesn't necessarily translate, though, into security.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's more of a mixture of folks that don't understand each other's domain. So, for example, a lot of times risk management folks are coming at it from a legal liability perspective, and their dialogue is not often really well comprehended back and forth with their technology people. And so you may often have very organizationally isolated groups of folks worrying about compliance versus worrying about actual security. So, you know, compliance is more of in a lot of ways, it's a paper exercise for a lot of different types of compliance, where we've certified that we have these controls in place, these are the procedures, et cetera. But does that mean you actually did them and tested them? I mean, one of the examples I gave in one conversation, it says, you know, have you ever been in your hospital walking by and looked in a wiring closet and saw the spaghetti in there? You know, of all those wires. It's like, who actually tested where that stuff goes? So I think the idea that sometimes, a lot of times, compliance is about building up a record of procedures and policies and things like that that aren't necessarily properly translated into physical controls and actions. So I think there's a domain and understanding gap that I've seen in a lot of these organizations.
And what's some of the gaps that we need in terms of research? You're working at Harvard. Are you guys working on some things that maybe we should know about? A couple secrets or tips?
Well, I think there's some of the things we've talked about. I think one, medical device resilience. You know, so for example, you know, we talked about mobile devices. You know, you got your iPhone out and you get this, you know, you get that email or that little one pops up on your settings and it says you need to upgrade your iOS and it says security patch. You hit the button right away. Most medical devices don't have anything like that. You know, so who's monitoring a lot of those? You know, how are they updated? How are they protected? In fact, in some cases with medical devices, the hospital that buys them can't try to upgrade anything on them because it would be violating the warranty. So I think understanding and securing devices is an important thing to think about. I think the other thing is that, you know, a real important dialogue between the risk management, the compliance, and the technology people in these organizations has to happen in a very way. I mean, I'm someone who between being a CIO at J&J or FDA, I actually think the technology stuff is usually pretty tractable. It's usually the human sociology pieces that can be complex. Getting the right people engaged around the problem at the right time with an equal amount of interest in solving it, sometimes that can be difficult. And so I think, you know, often for me, it's getting those different people together and finding it. I mean, I've talked with a lot of hospital information security office, for example, and they're actually not in the loop of what type of equipment is being purchased because it's a different department. But that other department wants that hospital equipment networked. So there's those type of social gaps, I think, that are probably the most glaring as far as opportunities. I think the other thing is that you really want to train people on how not to be the victim or the vector. Because I mentioned the example of a nurse making an email mistake. I mean, you know, people work really, really hard, and mistakes are human. But making sure people are properly trained and have access to knowledge and who to ask questions to can actually go a long way with these things. Frankly, I actually think those types of social interventions are actually a lot better than a lot of, you know, there's this technology company that says they can ensure that your network doesn't get X, Y, or Z. I mean, I think there's a lot of cybersecurity snake oil out there in the technology market that we need to be careful of. There's also some fantastic services and products. But I think a lot of folks are looking for that next technology solution, and you're not going to get a technology solution that keeps someone from clicking on the wrong email.
Yeah, clicking on that phishing expedition, which you don't want to be phishing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much. We've been talking with Dr. Eric Paraxlis, Executive Director of the Center for Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, about cybersecurity and healthcare, what we should know. And we just really want to thank you. I think you've reminded us all that we all have our own role to play. You have the role to play as a national expert and leader, and we really appreciate the roles that you're doing in this regard. And the opinion piece in New England Journal of Medicine that we'll link to our website. But you do remind us as patients and as providers and as healthcare systems, we have to take up our own roles.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jessica Hart.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have any questions you'd like us to address on an upcoming show or any comments, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call today about someone who's got a difficult trial with metastatic colon cancer.
I'm a 64-year-old woman with metastatic colon cancer, which I've had for 2 years. It seems stable. While not curable, I'm still doing many of the things I enjoy. Recently, I went to my family doctor, and she asked me what I enjoy most about living. I'm so happy when she asked about this in addition to the feelings when I feel bad about. I prefer to focus more on living than feeling bad. I just wanted to share my story.
Well, we appreciate you sharing that story, and it's, I think, a really good reminder to doctors and to all of us about sometimes what's really important to people isn't about what makes them ill.
Exactly. We're so sorry to hear about your diagnosis, but it's wonderful to hear that you're still able to do what you love most in life.
And the fact that your cancer has been stable, and I also hear sometimes from many cancer patients that they do want to talk about the things they really do still enjoy doing. And I think sometimes as doctors, you know, one of my first questions that you say when people come in is like, what brought you in today? Like, you know, like, what's wrong with you? Like, what are you ill with? And this other question about the kinds of things that really make us happy in life is not one a lot of times I think we ask, but it's a really good question.
Exactly. Focusing more on treating the person and not the disease.
And that way we can probably find out some other elements that we can perhaps look forward to, which is actually called hope. And that's something we'd also use more of and give more of in medicine. Erica, what's our very next house call?
My doctor told me that if I lost weight, I may be able to get off some of my diabetes medication. I've lost 20 pounds and my hemoglobin A1C is normal. My doctor then said I should wait before stopping my medication, but I think my diabetes is cured. What do you think?
Well, I want to commend you on your hard work and losing weight. I think that's wonderful. And Adam, what has your experience been with counseling patients on reducing their medication when their hemoglobin A1C appears to be normal?
Well, first off, yahoo! You know, this is kind of great news. This is the kind of stuff that we live for. You know, it's hard to believe, but I can't tell you, I've had so many conversations in the last year, Jessica, about being able to say to folks, you know, you came in this year and you've done some right things with weight loss and exercise and you're healthier than you were a year ago. And this is just an example of that. But, you know, when to stop the medicine, that's a little bit more difficult conversation, because while the hemoglobin A1C may be normal, maybe it's still high normal. Maybe it's not low normal. If it was low normal, I would be worried about low blood sugar, things like what do you see sometimes with low blood sugar?
People feeling sweaty and nauseous, maybe lightheaded. I mean, the biggest concern is losing consciousness if the blood sugar gets too low.
And if you were on insulin, we probably certainly would be cutting back. But maybe it's if your hemoglobin A1C, which is that 3-month average blood sugar, if it's at the upper end of normal, I would say, yeah, it seems reasonable to wait another 3 months, continue your weight loss, and then let's check it again. And if it's then even lower, that's a time when I would stop it. I wouldn't want to stop it too soon, but boy, you're on the right path.
Keep up the good work.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
I've had low back pain on and off for over a year now. I'm worried it could be my kidneys. It doesn't burn when I urinate, but I've heard people with kidney stones have back pain. Should I see a specialist?
I think the first thing would be to go in and talk with your primary care doctor before focusing in on a specialist, because it doesn't sound to me like it's actually kidney stones that's causing your pain. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, you know, this is difficult. A lot of people worry a lot about kidney stones. Kidney stones are pretty frequent down in the South where we are located now, certainly in the summertime when it's hot. But there are a lot of other things that are commonly. I mean, what are some of the things that you can think of that happen to people with pain kind of in the lower back?
Well, depending on your age, you can have just degenerative joint disease from or disc disease from having lived a long life.
Yeah, that arthritis and inflammation in the low back, and that's painful. And boy, that is a lot more frequent than kidney disease.
Exactly. And with kidney disease, you'd think more of the pain with urination, maybe seeing some blood in your urine and some nausea, cramping, things like that.
And, you know, when someone does have a urinary tract infection, it usually, not always, does burn when one urinates. Kidney stones, it doesn't usually burn. So that doesn't really help us. But, you know, there are other ways that we can, you know, try to figure this out. If you don't have a fever, sometimes if you just take some ibuprofen or some anti-inflammatory and it gets better, you know, kidney stones probably wouldn't get better with just that, though they could simply. So, you know, I agree, Jessica. Going in and see your family doctor or your primary care physician, internist, that's a good thing and could probably help diagnose this pretty quickly, either with some blood work or some x-ray, a urine test. You know, these are all good things.
Exactly.
Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm a Vietnam War vet who received several medals for my service. Recently, I've been experiencing problems with anger. My wife says I appear to be edgy all the time. My doctor thought I could be suffering from PTSD. Why would it be happening now? Should I see a therapist?
Well, first, I want to thank you for your service in the Vietnam War, and I'm sorry to hear that you're experiencing some problems with anger.
Yeah, and we should say what PTSD is, too, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a constellation, a bunch of different types of symptoms related to a pretty traumatic event that occurred at some point in time one's life. And for many veterans coming back and serving admirably and honorably in Vietnam, they did suffer from PTSD, as do many of the vets who are returning from service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Exactly. You're exposed to situations that you've not been exposed to before going to war, and it's hard to forget those memories and whether they are appearing now or immediately after your service. I don't think it's that strange to have something like PTSD develop this long after you were in combat.
And I bet if we were to bring the family in here, which is where you may need to go as well, because this could be how this is affecting your family, because I think you mentioned that the anger and, you know, your wife, and we would want to kind of maybe have a family conference to talk about this. And then the key is really is getting you in with some therapy, because PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is treatable with therapy to really help out, and you can make these symptoms of anger much better with some good treatment, maybe even some medication.
Or identify another source for the anger if it's not the PTSD.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, Jessica. We've had a good chance to talk about asking people what makes them happy in their life in addition to illness, about weight loss and diabetes and when it's time to maybe get off your medication.
And then a discussion on whether low back pain could be attributed to kidney stones. And finally, the likelihood of PTSD several years after service in combat.
So we want to thank you for joining us today for your health.
We hope we have addressed issues and concerns important to your health. Please share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Again, that's yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, University of North Carolina Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Eric Paroxalis. And of course, I want to thank our guest co-host, Dr. Jessica Hart. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Jessica Hart.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.